Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots reggae, dub and sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Kareni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
Hi everyone, my name is Tierney from Titanio Dakota, and you're listening to Island Music.
Search up ABC Island Music to listen online or find it on the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
The danger is very real because unexploded bombs are often hidden in places where families live their daily lives. The danger really is silent and invisible. You may not know it's there until it's too late. It's not just history. It's an everyday safety risk for ordinary families.
It's more than 80 years since the end of World War II. While many Western nations rebuilt and moved on, the Pacific is still living with the war's legacy. Islands became battlefields. Villages were taken for military bases. Whole nations endured brutal occupation. And what the war left behind still shapes life today. So, what did World War II leave in its wake 80 years on? And where do we go from here? Unexploded bombs still lie hidden beneath village soil. Rusting shipwrecks leak into the sea, polluting marine habitats. And across the Pacific, the children of wartime unions with foreign soldiers continue to carry that legacy. I'm Afmasanga Seyuli Salama Sina Von Raiki, and this is Culture Compass, an exploration of survival, revival, and connection throughout the Pacific. In September 2025, the President of the Federated States of Micronesia, Wesley Simina, declared a state of emergency over the lingering dangers of World War II relics. Toxic oil has been leaking from a sunken warship into Chuuk Lagoon, spreading to nearby islands and threatening marine life. Local residents have been warned about hazardous fumes and contaminated water. President Simina addressed the United Nations General Assembly in New York, raising the alarm on this urgent environmental threat.
This ship, together with more than 60 other wartime wrecks, has rested in our waters for nearly 80 years since the war's end. But now, these remnants of conflict pose new dangers as toxic oil seeps into our ocean, threatening our fisheries, coastal communities, and livelihoods. The scale of this crisis far exceeds Micronesia's capacity to address alone. As we mark the 80th anniversary of the war's end, we appeal to the international community to work with us in transforming this legacy of war into an opportunity for cooperation.
Across the Solomon Islands, the environmental scars of the war can be seen on their shores too. Like many countries across the Pacific, Solomon Islanders live with the daily threat of unexploded bombs and landmines. They're buried under the soil of what's now suburban backyards and school grounds. Mavelin Pitanoi is a blast survivor turning tragedy into action. In May 2021, she was at a church fundraiser when an unexploded bomb went off, changing her community forever. Today, she leads Bomb-Free Solomon Islands, a charity dedicated to clearing hidden ordinances and protecting her people.
Just along the beaches, you will see big war relics like aeroplanes, like fighter planes and other relics lying on the beach, contaminating the shorelines. And even when you get on the plane or you come down the plane, like taking off or landing, you can see the war relics on both sides of the runway. This is an evidence that the war relics and unexploded bombs are still scattered across the islands. And it shows that the war dangers are still very much alive today.
And that's from 80 years ago. That's a long time. From your perspective, how dangerous is it for everyday people, for families farming, fishing, or even cooking outside?
The danger is very real because unexploded bombs are often hidden in places where families live their daily lives. Farmers, they risk their lives digging into the gardens. Fishermen, you know, they encounter unexploded bombs in rivers and coastal areas. And even people cooking outside, like what happened to us 4 years ago. These were all buried under the ground. And, you know, the danger is still there. The danger really is silent and invisible. You may not know it's there until it's too late. That's why communities like my community continue to suffer injuries and loss. It's not just history. It's an everyday safety risk for ordinary families when they try to live a normal life. Just a few months ago, I constructed a win-win house just in front of my house. Win-win house is just the structure with the roof so that we can have open space looking out into the ocean. And while digging, my boys found a pipe that was, you know, lying there since 80 years ago, just beside my house. And I shouted at them. I told them to stop immediately. And I called the EOD team to come in just to check if it's an ordinary pipe or if it's something else.
Beyond the physical risks, what kind of emotional or social trauma do these weapons leave in communities?
Survivors like me carry trauma, fear, and sometimes shame while families, you know, some families grieve the sudden loss of loved ones. Parents, you know, they worry about their children going out to play or even to school. My son went to St. Nicholas High School where they found 260 bombs last, because the beginning of this year. And he doesn't want to go back to school for 2 weeks. So this is just an example of the reality that we're living.
Can you take us back to 2021? What happened on the day of the blast that changed your life?
Well, it was on a Sunday, 9th of May, when people are celebrating Mother's Day. I was with the youth helping my church youth with the fundraising event. We cooked on the ground, not knowing that a bomb was buried beneath us, and it exploded. That explosion, you know, carries that moment that changed my life, my family, and my community. It just happened very quick because we've been cooking on that spot since 9 o'clock in the morning till afternoon when towards 3 o'clock, and we had the explosion. I didn't know that a bomb was beneath us, but it did explode that day. And that moment changed my life forever.
It's very hard to hear you say that.
We lost two boys, one on the day and the other one a week later. Those two boys were with me. The three of us were standing around the fire cooking, and they were helping me with the dish. They held the dish for me to scoop whatever we were cooking from the pot into the dish that they were holding on to. Yeah, so the three of us just fly out from the spot. And I was shocked. I couldn't believe what had just happened. Because growing up in the village, I used to see war relics across. I live near the sea. I used to see these remnants of war along the seashores. But growing up with it, I thought it's not really that harmful to me. Not until it happened to me, then, you know, it wasn't something I expect would happen to my own life.
2021 is very recent. You're still experiencing a lot of trauma from this. So how did your experience shape the way you see the legacy of World War II in the Pacific today?
To me, World War II legacy is not just history, because it's still dangerous today. You know, it reminds me that awareness and action is a must. And these actions, they still needed to keep on happening.
You've spoken about victim assistance being more than just medical treatment. What kinds of support do survivors need physically, emotionally, and economically?
For me, survival assistance goes far beyond medical treatment. Not physically, I need ongoing rehabilitation. I know this would be the same for other survivors and victims. So I need ongoing rehabilitation and care for the lasting injuries that I had from the explosion. These scars that I'm carrying, they will be here. Long-lasting scars that I have. Now, emotionally, I carry trauma and grief and anxiety every day. So counseling and mental health support are essential.
Yeah.
And economically, my family and I have struggled with loss of income since I lost my job. And this disrupted my livelihood with my children and my family, my community. So financial support, even skills training and opportunities to rebuild our lives are all critical.
What does a bomb-free Solomon Islands do to support victims and to build safer, more resilient communities?
It may be new, but our mission is personal and urgent, okay? We want to support survivors, help them heal, regain hope, and rebuild their lives through financial support, skill trainings, and new opportunities. And our vision is the future where communities feel safe, resilient, and empowered to try despite the hidden dangers left behind by the past wars. So it's new, but this is our mission and our vision. Our vision is a future where communities feel safe. We empower each other despite the hidden dangers so that we can rebuild, we can heal, we can move on with our lives.
A safe space?
I have committed a space under my house so that the other victims can come and we can sit and we can cook together. We can share our stories and encourage each other out. I also start up a background vegetable garden just to show other victims that even if we lost our job, we can still do this to cut down on the costs of groceries at the market. So this is just to show the other victims that we can still do something to help ourselves. Otherwise, we will be waiting forever. No one will help us.
Solomon Islands isn't alone in this. Communities across Micronesia, Papua New Guinea, Palau, and elsewhere face similar dangers. How connected are these struggles across the Pacific?
We share the same struggle. We share the same pain. We all have the same dream. Our country must be cleared of UXOs. So we must come together to raise awareness so that people responsible must come and clear the hazards to protect our lives, to support survivors and to restore safety and hope to our communities.
So do you think the nations who fought the war, like Japan and the United States, are doing enough to acknowledge and take responsibility for this ongoing legacy?
Well, I appreciate the support Japan and US have already provided. There is still much to be done. I think victims like me continue to suffer, and the land is still contaminated with hidden explosives. Until survivors are fully supported and the land is cleared, I feel they are not doing enough. Most importantly, I want to see the international community to recognize that the legacy of the war is not just history. They must recognize that it is still affecting people like me today, and we need help to heal and rebuild our lives.
The Pacific may have been the battlefield, but some of the war's deepest impact was on families. Across the region, at least 4,000 children were born to Indigenous women and American servicemen. many growing up without their father figure in the shadow of stigma and silence. Sawia, Dr. Louise Matai-Amilo, has spent years bringing these overlooked stories to light. Through her research and conversations with Samoan women and the children of wartime unions, she reveals a human side to the war. Please be aware, this interview contains references to sexual assault.
There were several kinds of relationships. The first one was maternal. I say maternal because when the American troops came, some of those boys were young as underage boys, 13, 14. And so some of the families, they adopted some of these boys as their malingi, their person to look after. And also, when the Marines arrived, their accommodations were not ready. And so the only way to accommodate them is to billet them out in the villages. And that is how they came in contact and lived with our people. They befriended our people, not just women, but our young men as well, who worked with them. And that's how they gained the skills. There were also relationships ensued between younger women and Marines as well. It's natural to have affection with each other, or maybe not. There were also some other relationships. Truth be told, some had sexual encounters. Some of those encounters were coerced. Some of those other encounters, we only just found out about them when we asked the women who were part of the war. There were relationships ensued which resulted to marriages, and marrying an American soldier was very difficult then because it was not allowed. But despite that, there were love stories. But then there were also stories that were quite hurtful when mothers as old as early 90s, when I found them, talked about for the first time about rape and how they were victims of that.
Many children were born from these unions. How did Samoan families and communities receive these children?
That shame was seen as something shameful to the families. The other side of the same coin, where you have a new addition to the family and they were accepted. And I found that in some cases there was acceptance, but there was negligence. Some of these children were not treated fairly, because they were singled out and were, in today's terms, abused. There was a lot of favoritism, but not to the American baby.
How accepting were the fathers of these children?
What some of the soldiers did was give them a name that was not the right name, that was not their real name, but used a different name that was given to the partner. And so when it was time to, when the child came of age and tried to find the father, it was very difficult. I know there have been some children who have tried all their lives to find their American aina, but they were not successful. Now with the genetics and the DNA, some of them have found their families, but many did not.
After the war ended, did many of the servicemen return back to America? Are there stories of some staying behind?
After the war, once the rollout came, everyone has to go, because otherwise if you stay, you'll be seen as running away from it. But everyone were deployed elsewhere in the Pacific or back home. There have been cases where they came back to look for the women that they had relationship with.
You've described how some families kept these stories hidden for years. Why do you think there's still such silence around this part of Samoa's wartime history?
there is this stigma, the shame, and they put it on this kid and on this woman. And why people are always silent about it? Because it showed a break in the way they have behaved. It was a time when it was seen that the Samoan people would have let their guard down. They had abandoned Samoa, the ideals of what a Samoa should be, and they did not live according to those traditional ideals. The Samoan ideals of genealogy is that both sides are recognized, but the connections there, when one side is a lot more pronounced than the father's side, and in a society where that the father's side is seen to be presenting power, and that is not there.
80 years after World War II, how can storytelling, research, or projects like yours help communities heal and reclaim these histories?
We need to talk about it more. That is the number one thing. And we need to remember that our history, the story has power to heal in several interrelated ways, especially for individuals and communities like ours that navigated trauma, loss, or social change, profound transformation there. And I think in the context like Samoa and other Pacific societies affected by war, we may not have been the battlefront because we were far behind the line, but we were still affected by the war. At the same time we were affected by the war, there was still the layer of colonization and local upheaval that we had to go through. And so storytelling and oral history, they serve both as personal therapy and collective restoration. Now, these women suffered in silence. We owe these women an apology as a society for seeing we did not. Well, we're too general, we're too judgmental. The other thing is to looking at connecting generations. It's the importance of storytelling because it bridges the past and present. It allows younger generations also to inherit not only the trauma, but also the wisdom and the strategies for survival, learning from the stories of older women, meaning making of the elders. I think that fosters a sense of lineage and belonging.
Georgina Cora is the granddaughter of one of these wartime unions. Her grandmother, Ruby Bolin, a Ni Vanuatu woman, and her grandfather, Joe Allen, a U.S. pilot, met while they were stationed near Ruby's village. Their love gave birth to Georgina's mother, Mary. Following in her late mother's footsteps, Georgina has been working to trace her grandfather's family lineage, connecting the story of their family from Vanuatu all the way to the United States.
We don't really talk about her part of the early stages of her life because it's a bit of shameful and sad to talk about. But Mom grew up with my grandma and her grandmother.
What have you learned about your grandfather, Joe Tedro Allen, both from your grandmother's stories and from the documents you've found?
He seemed to be a very loving and caring person, but I wish I could have known him personally, so then I would know exactly what type of a person he is.
And after the war ended, do you know what happened between your grandmother and grandfather?
My grandmother was pregnant with my mother, so they left New Hebrides for New Caledonia. That was where Mum was born on the 15th of March, 1945. And they were in New Caledonia up until Mum was 6 months. Then Grandma said she took my mum. They boarded a plane and came back to New Hebrides, Vanuatu. And I'm not sure whether my grandfather stayed on or he too left for America. Because after that, what Grandma said was that she heard that she got news that the ship that they were boarding to go back to America hit a mine out in the sea, out in Costa Rica. So I'm not sure whether they were giving a true information to my grandmother and to the other women in the Pacific about the ship running into a mine, or was it just a lie? So they were, you know, they'll just forget those men, because I understand that most of those men that came into New Hebrides for war, most of them were married.
Did your mother or grandmother speak much about this time?
My grandmother mostly, you know, she loves to say stories about how when the bombs would go out, blast, and how my grandfather would take the jeep and come and check on her at a place where they were staying, Mel Coffee, and then return back to duty. She really loved my grandfather because even though she married to my step-granddad, but it's something that she loves to talk about to me.
Did your mother ever try to search for her dad?
I think she called the directory in America and she got some contacts. I remember very well, it was late in the 80s when she came back home with Dad and she was all down because what she told Dad was that, I think I found him. And then, like, she was sad. She called several J.T. Allen, but they told her no, they didn't serve in the war. But there was this one. He answered. Mom introduced herself. He went silent. Then he told Mom not to call that number. That was so heartbreaking for Mom because she really wanted to find him. She thought that he cared because he even signed her birth certificate. But I think because he's already married and he came and made another life here in New Hebrides, then going back, maybe he just doesn't want to get involved again.
What did that search mean for your mom and for you as her daughter?
We really want to find mom's roots. We want to find our other half of the family. So my mom didn't find her. I mean, she didn't find her other half. And unfortunately, she died in 1992. And it's heartbreaking because a child has to know her biological father. Okay, if you have somebody else, but at least acknowledge your child.
You've been looking into your family's history for quite some time now. What's been the most interesting discovery you've come across in your research?
When I got my mom's birth certificate from New Caledonia and the initials on my mom's birth certificate, my grandfather signed it. Okay. And then along the way during my research, I found an old census record from Mississippi. And this J.T. Allen initial that was on this census, it was the same as the one on my mom's birth certificate. And it was so interesting. But then when I followed it up, researched it even further, that J.T. Allen, that same initial, died in 1998. The date of birth for him and the one that was recorded on my mom's birth certificate both matched, and also the initials. I would have loved if he was still alive, because then I would have tried my best again to contact him. We know we've moved on. Everybody's moved on, but at least give us some closure.
80 years on, the Pacific is still clearing the wreckage of a war it didn't start. In the soil, in the sea, and in family histories. But when we tell our stories, something shifts, and hopefully help can follow. And when communities are heard, they can begin to heal. This is Culture Compass on ABC Radio Australia. Culture Compass is hosted by me, Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki. And our ABC Radio Australia executive producer is Falyangafulu Inga Stunsner. From Deadset Studios, our producer is Lucy McAfee. And our supervising producer is Kim Lester. Sound design is by Nick McCorriston. This episode was produced on the lands of the Turrbal and Jagera people.
we pay respect to the elders past and present.